God, don't be disturbed. And then God gives the reason why. And remember, God doesn't just chop off weeds on the surface, but he gets down underneath and deals with the cause of the disturbance. The sixth vision in chapter 5 is the vision of the flying roll, or the flying scroll. You see, in those days, instead of having books, they had rolls. And the scriptures were in roll form, scroll form, to be unrolled rather than books, to be opened as ours are. Mention and discuss what you believe to be the central message of this vision, and show how it's related to the main emphasis of chapters 1 to 6. Let me summarize it in these words. Don't be disturbed. I will completely judge all evil by my word. Don't be disturbed. I will completely judge all evil by my word. Now, I like to go and relate this passage to Jeremiah 23:29. Jeremiah 23:29 says, "Is not my word like a fire, saith the Lord, and like a hammer that breaketh the rock in pieces?" How does God judge evil? God judges evil by his word. Jeremiah 23:29. Now, in order to get this passage before you, I'd like for you to notice three great characteristics of God's judgment, which are revealed in the symbols here. The first characteristic is that God's judgment is swift. There is a flying roll. In other words, the passage in Isaiah, it says that God hath indignation against the wicked every day. Not only will God pour out his wrath upon the earth at the end, but he has indignation with the wicked every day. And all we must not lose sight of that. Oftentimes when you look out on the world, it seems to you as though God is wrongly slow in bringing judgment. But God's judgment is swift, and that's the meaning of the symbol of the flying roll. See, when a thing flies, ordinarily it can go more rapidly than that which is on the ground. Then the second characteristic is that God's judgment is great. Now, where do you get the idea of greatness of judgment from the idea of the flying roll? You get it from the size of the roll. Did you notice the Bible gives us a mention? It says that the flying roll was 20 cubits long and 10 cubits wide. Now, one thing is sure about the cubit. The cubit is at least 18 inches. The cubit is at least a foot and a half. Now, some would think the cubit's more than that. It is what some call the geometric cubit, which is 6 times as big as that. It would be 6 times a foot and a half, 9 feet. But we know it was at least a foot and a half. So let me check it off for you. 20 cubits long would be at least 30 feet long. And here's the idea of 30 feet. From here to the wall, so that's the length of the cubit, and then the width of it is at least 15 feet. You know, you can just step off just about the width of this board. You got to stretch it off. 5 times 3. This is 15 feet across. So you can see the size of it and what the point is. The point is God's judgments are great as well as great. Then there's a third characteristic of God's judgment. And we find that in the next question. Explain the meaning of the underscored words in Zechariah 5:3. Then said he unto me, "This is the curse that goeth forth over the face of the whole land. Over the word curse will you write sentence of death." This is the curse, this is the sentence of death that goeth forth over the face of the whole land. "For everyone that stealeth shall be cut off on the one side according to it. And everyone that sweareth shall be cut off on the other side according to it." Now, why does he mention those two commands? "Thou shalt not steal," and "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." You see, those commands are representative commands. The one stealing is taken from the second table of the law. And what it means is that judgment is pronounced upon everyone who breaks the second table of the law. And then the other command about swearing is taken from the first table of the law. And you see, God's judgment is pronounced upon everyone who breaks the first table of the law. Well, you see, what is this characteristic of God's judgment? God's judgments are complete. God judges everything, all things. And you say, no, God, you just mentioned two. But you see, these aren't two isolated sins. These are two representative sins. You see, rather than just going down through the catalog of every sin in the book, often you mention two mites and nothing registers. But he just mentions two, one from the second table of the law and one from the first table of the law. All right, to summarize it, what's the meaning of this flying road? Why should we not be disturbed? Oh, you look out, there's so much sin in the world. But look what God is saying. I will completely judge all evil by my word. And then three characteristics of God's judgment. They're swift. He doesn't just wait till the end. That's a flying road. God's flying in judgment. They are great, the size of the road, and then they're complete, as indicated by this passage which we've expounded. The next vision, the seventh, is that of the flying ephah, mentioned and discussed what you believe to be the central message of this vision and show how it's related to the main emphasis of 1 to 6. Of course, in each case, we show how it's related by our words, don't be disturbed. And what's the reason here in this seventh vision of our meeting? I believe the answer is, don't be afraid, evil is under my control. And you see, the other version says that God quickly judges all evil. But now here's something beyond that, even apart from God judging us. Evil is under my control, and I will banish it. Then I want you to use two adverbs to show how God banishes it. I will banish it swiftly and completely. I will banish it swiftly and completely. So there is the evil under my control, and I will banish it swiftly and completely. Now you see, this figure of the woman in the ephah is only that of a debauched woman. I think that's the setting here. This is an immoral, debauched woman sitting inside the ephah. And then the column of lead is put down upon the mouth of the ephah. And that idea here is the whole situation's under control. That's a debauched woman, and debauched woman can certainly do a lot of harm. But she's under control. That column of lead is keeping her under control. Evil is under control. Then you notice that you have these with wings in their wings. Wings in their wings. That's what it is here. The idea of wings and wings. You see, it just accentuates the idea of swiftness. You see, wings are swift. And then wings just make the things even swifter. And that's where I get the idea of God swiftly banishing it. These who come with wind in their wings, it's just the idea of swiftness of banishment and swiftness of judgment. Now, you see the idea of ephah. What is ephah? Their ephah was a measure about the same as our bushel. Their ephah had about 9 gallons in it. But it was roughly the same as our bushel. So you can think of a bushel basket or an ephah. Now, you say, well, this isn't too large to have an adult woman in. Yes, it was in their mind. The ephah was one of the largest measures used by the Hebrews. They had their other measures, but that was one of their largest measures. And so what would this suggest to Zechariah's mind in the mind of the people who were getting the prophecy? I think the idea of much sin and debauchery, this immoral, debauched woman in this big ephah, but there's a column of lead on it. Evil is under God's sovereign control. Oh, friends, I know nothing that blesses me and gives me any more peace than that. Even my sin is under God's sovereign control. Even your sin is under God's sovereign control. And you see, if I want to be right with the Lord in my own life, there's an evangelical application to this to my own life. You say all the sin in the world is under control. Yeah, my sin's under control too. You know how many times you've come awful close to wrecking your life through your sin? But you haven't wrecked it. Even your sin is under God's sovereign control. Even my sin is under God's sovereign control. I mean, that's the message here, the blind evil. Don't be discouraged. Evil is under my control, and I will banish it swiftly and completely. Then the eighth vision of the fourth chariot. Now, before the word chariot, would you just insert this as a part of the hyphenated word, war chariot, the four war chariots. Mention and discuss what you believe to be the central message of this vision, and show how to lay the emphasis of chapters 1 to 6. Don't be discouraged. God's thoughts are fighting for you. Now, earlier when I taught this, I used to say that this eighth vision is just repeating again what the first vision did. The first vision said, you know, the horsemen among the lowly murderers. The first vision saying, don't be discouraged. God's hosts are fighting for you. And that's why you can interpret it. But this is coming back and emphasizing again the idea. You see, you start with that, God's hosts are fighting for you, in there. God's hosts are fighting for you. But I don't think that's the idea here. I think it's an advance in thought. God's thoughts are fighting for you. Here is war chariot. And you see, these Hebrews didn't have a lot of war chariots. They came back to Palestine to build a temple. And that was a boring. But the enemy had a lot of war chariots. And what was this little feeble group going to do? Didn't even have a wall to protect the temple. God built it with all the war chariots coming. But what would it mean to them? God what for fighting for you. What? Yes, in fact, God's army, but not the way we use the meaning. When we say God's army, we mean the people of God, or the angels of God. And I don't think what this is what this would mean to them or to Zechariah. The workers are fighting for you. God's army. Yes, God's enemies are fighting for you. Oh, that's a thrilling thing, young people. God's enemies are fighting for you. Of course, you can begin to hear it. You take the early church, you say, oh, the early church was at the mercy of the inferior Roman government. Not at all. That inferior Roman government greatly persecuted the early church, but without meaning to be afraid of fighting for the church of God. You know, the old adage, Father, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. None of me, everything will be easy going in my life when this is true. But one thing God uses to make you a better Christian is the enemies of God. Somebody said, oh, if everybody just pat me on the back and go the same way I'm headed, it'd be wonderful. No, it wouldn't be, then you wouldn't be fit to kill. If everybody just pat you on the back and went the same way. God's enemies are fighting for you. Why? Because they're under God's sovereign control. How well true that is. And you see, 2 Corinthians 12, 7 to 9 talks about Paul's thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan, the buffeting. Dr. Cleese used to say it was a messenger of Satan, but he brought God's message. And you see, it's just another way of saying, you say, all these, whatever their thorn in the flesh was, it was something Paul wished weren't there. But it was fighting for him to make him a better Christian. They'll be discouraged. God's enemies are fighting. I think that's the meaning of warfare. Not God's hope. You see, if it were that, then it's just a repetition in slightly different language of the first vision. But don't think it's that. I think it's God's enemies are fighting. Not the throwing thing in it again. And again, it emphasizes the sovereign control of God. Now, on page 140, we have the event which climax is these first six chapters. And you see, this is the crowning of the high priest, which is a symbolical act. And you have the first eight visions, which is symbolical vision. Now here's the symbolical act, the crowning of Joshua the high priest. Now before we answer the question, I want to realize what a sensational act was the crowning of the high priest. You just read that God put the kingly crown on Joshua's head and doesn't mean too much to you. But remember what a sensational thing it would be. The Old Testament history was it God's will for a man to be both king and priest at the same time? No. And therefore Melchizedek comes in. You see, Melchizedek was before the line of the Aaronic priesthood. And he was both king and priest. He was the whole show. But after the line of Aaron's done, nobody should be king and priest at the same time. I wonder if you remember God's great judgment falling on two kings of God's people. He probably was king and priest. Who was the first one on them? Saul. You remember Saul would wait for Samuel to come. He offered the sacrifice, and God deposed him from his office because of it. He announced the awful judgment on him. And who was the other one that went into the holy place and offered incense, and you know, 80 priests accompanied him into the holy place. And all of a sudden, those 80 priests, horrified, looked and saw the leprosy as it broke out on his forehead. Who was that? Remember, King of Judah? Uzziah, U-Z-Z-I-H. He's the one who lived 52 years of prophesying. You know, Isaiah says in the king, you were the king Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. That's the one. And when the Jews are thinking of that era, the Jews' history, they call it the Victorian Age. Ah, what a wonderful time that was. Yeah, how did it end? It ended. He had to move out of the palace and had to be quarantined in the house all by himself. Couldn't even go in the king's palace. Because he had the most dreaded of all on earth of Jesus. Why? Because he tried to be both king and priest. You see, that's the background for this. And that's what makes this symbolical act such an amazing thing. Now, what relation does this symbolical act, crowning Joshua the high priest, have to the eight visions? I think the answer is that it shows how the eight visions of encouragement are to be accomplished. How are these eight visions of encouragement to be accomplished? Somebody says, don't be scared, God's enemies are fighting for you. Yeah, but why are they fighting for you? So here's the answer. All these eight visions of encouragement are to be accomplished through the priest king. Through the priest king. Now I'd like for you to relate this to something written earlier in David's time, Psalm 110 verse 4. Psalm 110 verse 4 says, thou art a priest forever. Finish it for me after the order of whom. The order of Melchizedek. And then what book in the New Testament quotes that several times? Hebrews in the New Testament. You see, Zechariah depicts that truth of Psalm 110:4 and develops more in detail than Psalm 110:4 presented. Psalm 110:4 gives it in the simplest kind of speed form. But Zechariah here, chapter 6, develops it a little more, and then that just gets you right ready for the book of Hebrews. And you say, why are all these things true that I don't have to be disturbed? For further details, read Hebrews. See, Hebrews gives you the breakdown of it. We have such a high priest, and this moment he's praying for me. He's praying for all the people in the world. That's why we should not be disturbed. In other words, that one truth of Hebrews 8:1, the chief point is this, we have such a high priest. Comprehends all these eight visions. Somebody says, oh, I just can't remember this for the examination. I can't even remember from my own Christian life. But you've got them all wrapped up in one little bundle when you've got Jesus Christ, the great high priest, praying for you all the time. Who is it? He's priest and he's king. And I think that's the relation here. How do these visions of encouragement come out in fulfillment? How are they fulfilled? Through the priest king. And you see, this passage just gives you a little full development of Psalm 110:4. But Hebrews gives you a much fuller development of Psalm 110:4. You know, I often repeat this, but I believe the average preacher says far more about mother's prayer than he does about the Savior's prayer, and all what prayer. Why, through the years I've heard preacher after preacher saying, oh, I was wondering what your mother prayed for. Mother prayed for. Well, of course that's good. Thank the Lord for. But my, when a preacher gives you 10 sermons on that and then just casually say something on the side about Jesus praying for you, he's completely lost the perspective. The way I get all these into my soul is just this simple thing. I have a great high priest at the Father's right hand. He's interceding for me all the time. And that's the practical experience of these eight visions of encouragement. Now on page 151, we come to our general impression of Malachi, first principle, form general impression about Malachi.